Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Yeah.
So you've given us a really fascinating stack of sources this time, all about one surprisingly visceral topic.
Right. The role of flesh or fleisch in art.
Yeah, from cave paintings all the way to contemporary galleries. It's quite a journey.
It's a spectacular mission today. We're really tracking a kind of philosophical obsession. We're not just looking at, you know, paintings of meat.
No.
We're tracing how animal and human flesh has symbolized everything.
Yeah.
Survival, power, sin, divinity, mortality.
And ultimately, whether the human body itself is the final artwork.
Exactly. That's where it all leads.
You know, what strikes me immediately is that we all think of the modern shock artists.
Yeah.
A Sue Teen or maybe a Damien Hirst.
Mm-hmm.
But this core tension, it's been there for millennia. It's this conflict between the total transience of the body.
And the human quest for permanence, for beauty.
Yeah.
That is the engine driving this entire history. I mean, the fact that the physical substance we're made of is the thing that decays the fastest. It forces artists to confront mortality head on.
Art tries to capture the life of the flesh before it just vanishes.
Precisely.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting right at the very beginning of human expression.
Right. We have to start with the foundational distinction, how early humans depicted their own flesh versus the flesh of animals.
Two totally different things.
Completely. For human flesh, you have to think of the Venus of Willendorf from, roughly 25,000 BCE.
That famously heavy, almost abstract little figure.
Exactly. It wasn't a portrait. It was never meant for static admiration. It was a portable cult object.
Symbolizing fertility, abundance.
And it was the first real step toward placing the human body, human flesh at the center of, you know, artistic and symbolic focus.
And at the same time, animal flesh just meant raw power.
Overwhelmingly. You see it in the great prehistoric galleries like Altamira around 12,000 BCE.
Those bison, those horses, they're not just dinner.
No, they're symbols of dominance, of survival itself. And what's truly compelling is what the sources tell us about the composition of the art.
What it was made of.
Yes. The paint included iron oxides, charcoal, and sometimes actual blood.
Wow.
The act of creation literally gave the art a fleshy, visceral component. It connects the hunt directly to the canvas of the cave wall.
The desire for the persistence of the flesh, it gets even more explicit in antiquity, right?
Absolutely. Look at the Egyptian mummy portraits from the 2nd century CE. These weren't just, you know, fleeting likenesses.
No, they were aiming for something more.
They were aiming for what scholars call the persistence of the flesh. Beständigkeit des Fleisches. The portrait acted as a kind of physical double.
A companion for the deceased in the afterlife.
To secure that physical presence forever.
And then the Abrahamic traditions arrive and give the concept of flesh this immense spiritual weight. I was stunned to see that the word fleisch shows up 305 times in the Bible.
It carries this enormous symbolic load. It's sin, it's mortality, suffering.
But at the same time, it's life and love and strength.
That duality is the foundation of, really, all of Western artistic depiction. The entire Christian narrative hinges on the central figure being defined by flesh.
Jesus Christ is the flesh-made word.
John 1.14, God made physical.
Right.
And this leads directly to the Gothic period's focus on the man of suffering, the Leiden's men.
Where Jesus is shown with very exposed, very mortal flesh, not just as a triumphant God.
Exactly. That vulnerability, that mortality was completely intentional. It allowed the human viewer to identify with his very real physical pain. It bridged the spiritual and the physical.
It perfectly embodies that constant struggle, doesn't it? The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak.
The earthly body is always holding back the spiritual ambition. And artists, especially in the early Renaissance, they had to master how to capture that living quality of the skin. Hubert van Eyck in the Ghent altarpiece was considered a genius of incarnat.
Wait, incarnat? Is that just a fancy Italian-derived term for flesh tone?
It is, but it's a bit more profound than just a color swatch. It denotes the mastery required to capture the living quality of naked human skin.
So the subtle variations, the blood underneath.
The softness, yes. It signals a profound understanding that without mastering the flesh, they couldn't convey the humanity the religious narrative demanded.
That mastery of the surface takes us beautifully into the Renaissance, which wasn't just about beauty, but science.
A shift from a theological insight to literal physical insight into the flesh.
And no one embodies this more than Leonardo da Vinci.
Oh, absolutely. But we know he conducted these secret nocturnal anatomical studies. I mean, he was literally digging up and dissecting fresh corpses.
Which was incredibly risky back then.
And he wasn't doing it for medicine. He was doing it to advance his art.
His sketches, like embryology, you can see that blend of scientific detail and pure artistic line.
And society absorbed the scientific display in public. Rembrandt's 1632 Anatomy of Dr. Tulp is the perfect example.
The center of the painting is the open flesh of an executed street robber.
It was a major societal spectacle, not just a classroom lecture.
But here's something that genuinely surprised me in the sources.
Yeah.
They point out that Rembrandt's rendering of the muzzle course on the arm, it was anatomically incorrect.
It was. Yeah.
So does that mean accuracy mattered less than the dramatic, visceral impact?
I think so. It suggests the purpose was more philosophical, not purely didactic. The scientific error is almost irrelevant next to the emotional effect.
Huh.
What's fascinating is the famous shadowing on the faces of the doctors observing the corpse. It's often interpreted as the umbra mortis.
The shadow of death.
A stark reminder to all the viewers of their own fate as they stare into that exposed body.
The power of the open wound also just do. It changes dramatically. The sources contrast Botticelli's St. Sebastian.
From 1474.
Right, where the arrows are almost decorative. It's a very polite, distant kind of wound.
And then you get the Baroque era. Caravaggio takes the wound and makes it the central point of faith itself.
In Doubting Thomas.
Thomas doesn't just look at the wound on the resurrected Christ. He physically places his finger into the gash.
It's an intensely fleshly depiction. It's meant to completely eradicate doubt.
You can't doubt what you can touch.
And flesh is always there, isn't it? Even when it's covered. Looking at Da Vinci's Last Supper, the little clues about future violence are everywhere.
Peter holds the knife. Judas clutches the blood money.
Jesus' own hand gesture points toward the wounds he's about to receive.
And the Baroque also brought the rise of the still life, turning animal flesh into the symbol of, well, economic dominance.
And fleeting wealth.
Friend Snyder's still life's just full of opulent game and fish. It was about celebrating rich consumption.
It's the visual equivalent of showing off your luxury car today.
Precisely. But the underlying message was always vanitas, transience.
Right.
Peter Klyes's still life's made this explicit. He used motifs like the skull, the extinguished candle for the dying spirit, the hourglass.
It's all about the rapid decay of that rich flesh and earthly life. Mm. But few artists of the period engaged with the raw, brutal reality of slaughter, quite like Rembrandt. His versions of the slaughtered ox were just startling.
Yeah, painting a hanging carcass wasn't exactly a commercial hit in rich, civilized Amsterdam.
Not at all.
No, it wasn't easy art. The later 1655 version, bathed in that dramatic chiaroscuro, is often read as highly biographical.
How so?
Many scholars see it as Rembrandt asserting, "I am this flesh, this raw mortality is the subject, and the subject is art." He tied his own mortality directly to the exposed reality he depicted.
That concept, flesh, as raw, exposed material, not just food or theology, it just explodes in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Which leads us straight into the butcher shop aesthetic.
Evis Corinth.
A major proponent. His painting Butcher Shop in Schifflarn, it blurs the line between the human butcher and the animal carcass, object and subject.
And he often used a visible scale in the painting, didn't he, to literally weigh appreciation against disgust.
He did. And then James Soutine pushed that sensory experience even further.
With his carcass of beef, he actually took these massive decaying carcasses home to his studio to paint them.
He did. I mean, you can only imagine the smell and the decay he was living with just to capture that realism.
That emphasis on the unbearable reality of the body.
Yeah.
It seems to manifest in two major ways.
Go on.
On one hand, you have artists looking inward. Frida Kahlo, after her horrific accident, focusing on her personal unbearable fleshly pain.
Using mirrors to perceive her own body for self-portraits like the open flesh.
And then on the other hand, you have Francis Bacon looking outward, explicitly referencing Rembrandt's ox in paintings like Figure with Meat.
Right. Bacon used flesh as an amplifier of power for his often monstrous figures. He recognized the raw, visceral beauty in the color of the flesh.
So if Kahlo is looking inward at her pain, and Bacon is amplifying power outward, are they fundamentally doing the same thing? Or are those two totally separate artistic missions?
I'd argue they're two sides of the same coin. They're both using the body's inescapable physicality to communicate an internal state. The physical substance is the medium.
And that idea just accelerates when artists stop depicting flesh and start using it as actual material.
Which brings us to the shocking and famous examples of meat art.
Janis Sturbach's Vanitas, Flesh Dress.
From 1987. A perfect modern Vanitas. It's a dress made of raw steaks. It explicitly links physical decay, transience, and...
and contemporary pressures on the female body.
Mm-hmm.
Anorexia, beauty standards, the demand to control the flesh.
And then you have conceptual performance art, where the body isn't just a visual metaphor, but an instrument of endurance.
Like Marina Abramovich's Balkan Baroque.
A prime example. Her four-day performance of intensely cleaning bloody, fresh cow bones.
Mm.
It was a visceral act symbolizing the suffering, the pain, the need for ethical cleansing after the Balkan conflicts.
And someone like Damien Hirst with his preserved animals.
This little piggy went to market.
Right. He combines that religious sacrificial connotation with the memento mori theme, but preserves it all scientifically in formaldehyde.
It's the ultimate statement of human dominion over and mastery of the animal body.
And all of these threads seem to push art to its conceptual limit. If the canvas is flesh, the subject is flesh, the material is flesh.
Then the person made of flesh is the art itself.
Here's where it gets really interesting. How does this whole historical study of flesh lead to the idea that we, the viewer, are the ultimate art object?
It's the logical, unavoidable endpoint. This was formalized by Tim Oryx back in 1961. He declared himself the first living work of art.
Which sounds incredibly self-centered, but the sources say it wasn't a purely egoistic act.
No, not at all. When Ulrich exhibited himself in a glass case, he always included a mirror.
Ah.
The audience wasn't just viewing him. They were forced to see themselves reflected in the art box. He was inviting them to perceive themselves as art, too. The viewer completes the piece.
And Piero Manzoni, a pioneer of conceptual art, took this even further.
By designating others as art.
Right.
His base magica, or magic base, from 1961 was just a pedestal.
For museum visitors to stand on.
Stand on it, and for a moment, you become object art. The artist's intention, not the object's form, defined the art. He later literally signed people's bodies.
Designating them as artworks until death. With specific stamps.
Exactly.
So the creation of art shifts from the artist's hand to the artist's signature, the declaration.
The flesh is the designated carrier of the artistic idea. And this whole philosophical trajectory culminates with Joseph Beuys,
who famously said, every human is an artist.
But later he escalated that idea. He said, it should come to the point where man himself becomes the work of art.
The universal potential is realized.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get the final, maybe somewhat uncomfortable, scientific reduction of this with Gunther von Hagen's Körperwelten, Body Worlds.
Von Hagen wasn't an artist. He was a conservator. He used plastination to preserve real human bodies.
But by removing the individual's identity, they're all anonymous donors, yeah, and focusing only on the exposed internal human substance.
The subject is reduced to a form of pure aesthetic display, a kind of subject art.
It comes full circle, back to that initial quest for the permanence of the flesh, but now achieved through science instead of paint.
If we connect all this to the bigger picture, the history of flesh and art is a continuous, relentless journey. It starts with animal power symbol.
And it ends with the physical manifestation of human identity, fear, and philosophical inquiry.
Right. The explosive interpretive power of depicting the body. The seductive red of love versus the terrifying red of guilt and death is why this theme has never, ever faded.
So we've seen flesh as food, as sin, as a scientific object, and finally as the canvas itself.
Mm-hmm.
But let's look at the modern context we started with.
Okay.
The sources remind us that today meat is utterly oversaturated with modern symbolisms,
mm-hmm,
environmental impact, ethics, politics, scandals.
It's hard to look at a carcass without thinking about all of those things. The modern abundance of meaning makes looking at the raw substance almost impossible.
Which makes me wonder about the most extreme visceral artist today. You know, take Hermann Nitsch and his blood rituals.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to be attempting what German critics call symbol liberation through symbol oversaturation.
Yeah.
He just piles on so much ritualistic blood and guts.
That he hopes to overwhelm the audience, to strip away all those modern political, ethical meanings.
To find the raw, original power of the flesh once more.
That's the tension. Is he successfully liberating the symbol?
Well, consider this. When we observe an artist attempting that liberation, are they finding the raw power of the flesh again? Or is the mind that recognizes that act of saturation and liberation? Is that the real private plastic, the ultimate artwork? You, the thinking observer, completing the circle that Ulrich started back in 1961,